Hello and welcome to episode 29 of Making a Killing, the podcast from Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative on how corruption is reshaping global politics. I'm Nate Sibley and we've got a very special episode for you today because we're celebrating the launch on November 23rd of our very own Casey Michelle's debut book, American Kleptocracy, How the US Created the World's Biggest Money Laundering Scheme in History. It's published by Macmillan and available to pre-order now in the US, the UK and Australia. And it's already received some rave reviews from The Economist, New York Review of Books and elsewhere. So I strongly urge you to pre-order or next week pick up a copy. But today, we'll be talking to Casey about American kleptocracy and how the book shows, through the very colourful stories of two famous kleptocrats from very different backgrounds, not only the role that US financial secrecy plays in facilitating transnational corruption, but why America has such an important role to play in driving back dirty money worldwide. Okay, well, hello and welcome. As I said, we're here for a very special episode of Making a Killing, not only with Paul Massaro as always, but with the star of the moment, Casey Michelle, whose first book will be published next week. So welcome to the show, Casey.
Thanks so much, Nate. Long-time listener and also long-time co-host, but first-time author.
Always wanted to come on.
Yeah.
So we're obviously really excited and really looking forward to diving into to talking a bit about your book, which deals with so many of the issues that we have talked about previously on the podcast. But you bring it to a sort of another level with all your investigative work and the way that you sort of thread the narrative together. But we're gonna sort of look a bit more into that for our guests and hopefully prompt them to fork out and buy your book as well, because it is an absolute rip-roaring read. But I wanted to start with a question for you, Casey, which is, the title of the book, American Kleptocracy, is actually quite provocative. You know, I didn't have to pay a bribe last time I went to see a doctor. As far as I know, President Biden isn't stealing hundreds of millions of dollars from the Department of Transportation budget or whatever. You know, we're not a kleptocracy, right? So why is the book called American Kleptocracy?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nate. I mean, you're exactly right. When we're talking about, as we've done on so many of these episodes and so many other talks, other conversations, other interviews, you know, when we're talking about kleptocracy or kleptocratic regimes, the U.S. is certainly not meant to be included as it pertains to the discussions of, the formations of, the structures of the regimes that we discuss, the Russias of the world, the Chinas of the world, the Kazakhstans of the world, the Angolas under the Dos Santos regime of the world, and on and on and on. The U.S. is still a free and fair and fully functioning democracy. We have our issues, and certainly we'll be working through those for years to come. But by no means is this book an argument that the government of the United States fits the technical or broader theoretical definitions of kleptocracy. However, and as I argue in the book, when we talk about kleptocracy, when we're talking about this modern phenomenon, what these regimes are taking advantage of, what these oligarchic figures and these kleptocrats are taking advantage of, what we're talking about is a transnational financial architecture that allows for the international and multi-jurisdictional flow of dirty, illicit, ill-gotten gains and wealth from source countries into separate new other jurisdictions, these so-called destination countries or destination jurisdictions, where the money is there washed clean, where the money is there housed, where the money is there hidden, and done so by so many of those that we describe as the enablers or the enabling class. And again, we've talked about that on podcasts previously. So Nate, this is a long roundabout way of saying, when I'm talking about kleptocracy in this book and framing it as American kleptocracy, my argument, and I'd like to think some of the data that I use in the book backs it up, illustrates that the U.S., while it is not a kleptocratic regime itself, has nonetheless, and to all of our detriment, transformed into one of, if not the go-to destinations for that kleptocratic wealth. I mean, the subtitle really gets to it. It's how the U.S. created this money laundering scheme. Again, as I describe it, the greatest money laundering scheme in history. And we can go through some of the details of how exactly that happened, the kind of tension that exists within that transformation, while the U.S. does remain the leader of anti-corruption and counter-kleptocracy effort. So again, all of which is to say, I'm not arguing that the U.S. is a kleptocracy. Never would I do that. And certainly that does not happen in the book. What I am arguing is that there are a number of industries, there are a number of loopholes and exemptions, and there are a number of enabling figures and classes of professionals that have the transformed the U.S. into one of the go-to destinations for all kinds of transnational and kleptocratic money laundering needs.
This is like a sprawling, as our listeners well know, this is just like a sprawling problem, a sprawling issue. And I think what your book does really well is sort of tie in the sort of maybe what on their own might be fairly sort of tedious sort of regulatory developments that took place in the States over the past century or so and in the Congress with a very sort of colorful narrative relating to two fairly well-known kleptocrats. So I guess to pick on them first, how did you choose the figures of Ihor Kolomoisky and Teodorin Obiang to illustrate this problem of Americanized kleptocracy?
Well, I will say, Nate, you know, in some ways I feel like those two kind of chose me, right? As I've been working on these topics for so long now, right? For so many years, you know, I could have chosen any number of Russian oligarchic figures, Chinese oligarchic figures, you know, again, Kazakhstani oligarchic figures, et cetera, but these two were the ones that I kept coming back to time and again. And without giving away too much of the book, again, we've talked about Obiang in previous episodes. He is currently the vice president of the small African country of Equatorial Guinea. His father is the longest standing dictator in the world. And when we think about kleptocracy, Obiang is really kind of the figure that comes to mind. He is the one that embodies so much of the kind of jet set mogul lifestyle. I mean, this is a guy who really wants to be the Jay-Z of Africa. He wants the records, he wants the yachts, he wants the women, he wants the mansions, all of those kind of trappings of modern elite wealth. Obviously, he is gaining that wealth from access to his father's regime and then a role within his father's regime. But I mean, he's really almost a caricature of a kleptocrat. You know, another federal investigator described him as the poster child of kleptocracy, and he really is. I mean, this is a guy who is just obsessed with his image and obsessed with feeling like and living like a celebrity. And as we know, befriending so many American celebrities as well. But beyond that, he's also been the subject of so many high profile investigations, asset seizures that give us this really unparalleled look into how kleptocratic networks operate. So that's really, when we think of kleptocracy in the 21st century, we think of Obiang. And again, he did so much of it in the US. But then there's this other story of a Ukrainian oligarch named Ihor Kolomoisky, who I'm sure many listeners have never heard of. Even those who follow the post-Soviet space are only kind of generally familiar with him. He's not related to the president. He has never been, especially at least before this current president in Ukraine, especially close to the regime or in the pocket of the regime. But he nonetheless was one of those figures that, as we saw across the whole post-communist space, rose among this broader oligarchic class, using his connections, using his connivance to seize assets, seize natural resource bases, seize entire effective industries, whether it was in steel or banking, and build up this incredible war chest on his own, and then use that for all different kinds of, as we now know, nefarious ends. You know, there's so many more details about what he was doing with his own private militias, what he was doing with in the aftermath of Ukraine's 2014 revolution that I don't want to spoil from the book, but suffice it to say, as we now know, or certainly has been alleged by Ukrainian investigators and the Department of Justice here in the U.S., so much of his wealth was not from any kind of entrepreneurial or pro-job growth, you know, machinations or investments. What has been alleged is that he was overseeing the biggest Ponzi scheme in Ukrainian history. Billions and billions of dollars looted, stolen from unsuspecting Ukrainian depositors. And as with so many other kleptocratic figures, moving that money and hiding that money and laundering that money in the United States of America. Now, the reason that I chose him, because we already have a similar dynamic with Obiang. The reason that I chose Kolomoisky is because he's not going to Malibu, California. He's not going to Miami or to New York. You know, again, these places we traditionally associate with this kind of upper crust kleptocratic wealth. He went to Cleveland, Ohio. He went to these small towns, these steel towns and factory towns in Illinois, in West Virginia, in Kentucky. And he put his money where nobody else was looking. He put his money in these increasingly destitute areas of the American Midwest, the American Rust Belt, that were really starving for cash. And all of a sudden, here's Kolomoisky's money. Here's his network talking about how the jobs are going to come back. There's going to be revitalization. Don't look too far into the sources of the funds. There's no reason for them to look too far because, again, these are the loopholes and the exemptions that we can go into more detail about. But what we now know is they invested hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in Cleveland, became the biggest real estate landlord there in these small towns that didn't have any other investments coming in. And these investments have effectively gone to rot since then. They've fallen apart. You know, workers have been laid off. There have been environmental degradation here in the U.S., poisoned rivers, all that. And these factories have now begun to fall apart, as well as some of these investments in Cleveland as well. So anyways, that's the reason that I chose these two stories in particular. They're kind of bookends for how modern kleptocracy works. On the one hand, you have the flash and the kind of pizzazz and, again, the jet set lifestyle of Obiang. But then you have the flip side, that you still have the same dynamic, the same financial flows, but it's not going to these major urban areas. It's going to these overlooked areas that so few of us have paid any attention to, let alone the effect that kleptocracy has on these manufacturing bases, on these, as we describe them, blue-collar parts of America that have accelerated what are already these environmental or economically declining regions. And we're only just beginning to learn about exactly what the damage is on the ground to those populations and then where things go from here.
But I should say, we may lose Paul at any point because he's in Congress at the moment and things tend to sort of kick off there. So Paul, if you wanted to jump in now while we still have you.
Sure.
If you had any thoughts for Casey.
I think that's a wonderful look and summary of the book. And I just kind of, I just kind of want to say congratulations, Casey, because the book is fantastic. One of the things we often struggle with, I think, in this space, because it's technical and it's money laundering and it's cash and it's economics and it's all the things that put you to sleep, right? I mean, it's all the things that usually foreign policy people don't want to do. You've made it so entertaining and so exciting and so accessible. And so the narrative is so wonderful. And I mean, you fly through this thing, right? I mean, that's what I think is actually, I mean, in some sense, for an old kleptocracy hand like me, maybe we'll call ourselves that one day, none of this comes as new information, but what is new is your presentation, which is just so, it's so important to put it like that because, there is a feeling of powerlessness and hopelessness and paranoia that permeates not just the United States, but a lot of democratic societies today. And it's hard for them to put their finger on. And what it is kleptocracy. What it is is the forces around the world that are engaging in this behind the scenes malfeasance that are hollowing out our political systems, our downtowns, our factories, that are destroying lives in this pernicious, slow, corrosive way. That's very hard to see sometimes. But again, you lay it out exceptionally well and. I think that's in one for me the most powerful reason to read your book. I also think it's what makes it the most what makes it such an important contribution to the sort of literature to the works, the journalistic works and whatever else out there on this is precisely that any constituent who's never heard of kleptocracy in their whole life can pick this up and get into it, which is just wonderful. Now. I had the honor of being on the epigraph of your book. Very, very, very.
Paul, if I can interject just momentarily, I deeply appreciate everything you're saying. And I do want to highlight that for how, in certain ways, depressing so much of this material can be. I do promise there are some fun stories in the book itself. But I do want to say that, Paul, to your point, the tone for the book is set at the very beginning. For my book, is set at the very beginning by a certain quote. I'll just read this really quickly. It's on the very first page. And again, I'll just read it right here. It goes something like this. The Cold War is over. The gangsters won. Which I think, again, we're coming up against the 30th anniversary of the Soviet dissolution. We're looking back on this entire period. And to reframe it and understand that the aftermath of the Soviet dissolution led to this rise of these mafiosi, yes, these mafia states, these kleptocratic figures. I guess I should say who that quote is by. That's by a gentleman named Paul Massaro. Nate, I'm sorry that you didn't get the opening quote in this one, although I do promise Nate is mentioned on a few pages toward the end as reasons for optimism.
Yeah, my advanced copy, I was delighted you mentioned me at the back and as someone you can enjoy talking about both kleptocracy and birdwatching.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you're in both the acknowledgments and the book itself, absolutely.
Even prouder of the birdwatching, really.
Oh, no, yeah, very much so. That. I mean, migration season is coming to an end right now, but there's always spring of next year. So, Paul, sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, it's so the question I have for you is really about that. So when I
when I look at this book and I look at what you've written, and I mean, it really is my own interest too. I mean, you know, really it's the story of how the end of history failed in one way. It's a story about the end of the Cold War in the last 30 years, you know, and why democracy has not triumphed in the way that we thought it would. In fact, it's very much on the defensive now. And you know, if you're me, but really, I mean, if you're ever any American, to me, the most burning question for you should be, why hasn't democracy triumphed? We were promised if we defeated communism, democracy would triumph, and it didn't. And in fact, we seem to have a rise of dictators like we've never seen. Really, since the USSR, maybe even more dangerous than the USSR, you know? So I guess if you could put that in that context, so not just the story, but what, how does the book talk about how that happened and the failure of the end of history?
And again, I want to get back to, I guess maybe this will answer your question in a roundabout way, Paul, but I want to get back to what I mentioned earlier. One of the core tensions in the book itself and in this broader fight against kleptocracy as we know it, certainly here in the U.S., it's this tension between the United States government, Congress, the White House in Washington, acting as one of, if not the global leaders in the fight against corruption, in the fight against kleptocracy. Again, the U.S. has been at the fore of so many of the key anti-corruption, counter-kleptocracy developments, even going back to before the end of the Cold War, even going back to the 1970s when you had the passage of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the very first piece of legislation banning bribery of foreign officials. You know, the U.S. was the first jurisdiction to identify money laundering as an individual crime. It was the, we had the Patriot Act in 2001, which effectively cleaned up the American banking sector and set the bar for what anti-money laundering looks like in the banking sector. You know, the U.S. was even the first one to have a dedicated task force to seizing the assets of kleptocrats and kleptocracy writ large. Again, so often ending up right here in the U.S. And that's happening federally. But then you have all these kind of subterranean non-federal elements that are taking place and transformations that are taking place as well. You have the transformations in the states, in places like Delaware, Wyoming, Nevada, and South Dakota, that because of their own sovereignty, their own sovereign abilities, can set up these own kind of miniaturized offshoring empires of their own, whether it comes to shell companies, whether it comes to trusts, certainly as we saw just last month with the Pandora Papers shining brand new light on how South Dakota has transformed into this kind of Caymans of the prairie. You know, you have the industries themselves, private industry, again, non-state operations in things like real estate, in things like private equity, in things like the art or auction market that, again, have no anti-money laundering regulations or are severely limited in what they have to do, and that can nonetheless welcome in as much illicit and kleptocratic wealth as they want. And then again, you have these non-state, non-governmental, private sector actors, private sector figures, the enablers. This enabling class of lawyers, of real estate agents, of accountants, of art and auction house managers, that are the ones that are helping these dirty money streams navigate around the federal anti-money laundering provision. So again, when we're talking about whether it's the end of history, when we're talking about, you know, how the U.S. snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory, right? Yes. After the end of the Cold War, we, you know, 30 years is,
yes,
you know, is the kind of almost the perfect amount of time to look back at understanding that initial period in the early 1990s. Certainly the sense of hope, the sense of well-being, the sense of optimism that pervaded, and understandably so. I mean, I'm not begrudging any of that optimism from that period, while simultaneously being able to locate where the seeds of this kleptocratic development then came, where it was buried, how it first emerged, and what those policies, what those figures, what those industries looked like. I mean, it's, yes, hindsight is 20/20, but certainly in looking, putting this book together, I mean, it is as clear as day where this emerged, how it emerged, why it emerged. You know, none of this is necessarily inevitable, but certainly looking at some of these dynamics, you can't help but come away with a sense of inevitability and just pure chagrin and regret that more lessons weren't learned, more frankly, courage wasn't taken to push back against some of these enabling classes, these states, these policies, these loopholes, to make sure that we never ended up in a place like we did. And yet here we are. We know it needs to be done. I mean, Paul, the reason we only have you for a little bit is because you've been working to the bone in Congress with hearings, with legislation, with conversations about next steps. I know you're having, frankly, as busy of a week as I am, which is saying something. You know, it's 30 years on. We're only now beginning to address it. But thankfully, you know, without spoiling too much of the book, there is some optimism about where we're going next, about the next 30 years of this broader post-Cold War period that we're living through.
Casey, I wonder, you know, that's a perfectly good question for Paul. And we are so used to talking about kleptocracy and the end of history as starting sort of at the end of the Cold War. One of the interesting things, as I remember it from your book, is the extent to which all these kind of, you know, this when we talk about the sort of shadowy sort of legal infrastructure that underpins global kleptocracy, so much of it was invented here in the US for the purposes of corporations trying to minimize their tax burden, maybe wealthy people trying to minimize their tax burden. But the story starts so much earlier than the end of the Cold War. Without sort of giving, I know you want to sort of preserve a lot of the more fun and interesting detailed stuff for your book, but could you give us an idea, you know, for example, I had no idea New Jersey had a role to play in this, which I was delighted to find because my wife's from New Jersey. So when I read your book, I called her over and I said, hey, look, this kleptocracy stuff you have to listen to all day, it's actually your fault.
I will say to that point, Nate, listeners may be unaware, New Jersey does have some of the best birding in the entire country, Cape May, New Jersey. So sometime we'll make it down there. But, you know, I mean, this is one of the earliest chapters of the book, so I don't necessarily think I'm giving that much away. But you know, you're exactly right, Nate. So many of these, you know, this kind of flowering and explosion of kleptocracy in the last few decades, you know, certainly that has been confined to a number of developments, you know, the ease of financial transference that globalization brought with us. It's just a click of a mouse away. These systems have grown and perfected themselves, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, you're exactly right that, you know, I didn't know going into this book, researching this book, and then obviously putting this book together, that certain elements of this, especially on the kind of corporate shell company and anonymous corporate structure side, you know, this isn't something we only saw emerge in the early 1990s or through the 2000s. You can go back over a century to begin examining where and seeing where the contours of, in this case, anonymous shell companies, which in so many ways remain the key building block of kleptocracy, of transnational money laundering, and certainly of states like Delaware, you know, where it came into play. You know, there's far more details in the book, but I think listeners might be interested. You're exactly right. New Jersey was actually the kind of king of pro-corporate formation, or if you want to look at it another way, deregulatory formation in the late 19th century. That was for a few reasons. Again, it's a, you know, relatively smaller state. It's kind of squashed between the Pennsylvanias and the New Yorks of the world, certainly the political center in Washington, D.C. It didn't have the natural resource base. It didn't have the kind of broader economic underpinnings that some of these other larger states around it did. But what it did have, and this is the same dynamic we have seen in Delaware, in Wyoming, in South Dakota, what it did have is control over how to create a financial architecture within the state. It has the sovereign right to do this. Washington can't do, won't do anything about it. It has the sovereign right to create as much ease of access to shell companies, corporate formation, corporate protections, corporate secrecy as any other state. But it had that much more incentive because it didn't have any other real revenue generating mechanisms elsewhere. But the reason that we're not talking about New Jersey as the king of anonymous shell companies is because there was a certain figure named Woodrow Wilson. I think listeners may be more familiar with him as the American president during the First World War. Before that, his claim to fame was being the New Jersey governor. And he didn't like the transformation that was taking place. He didn't like the fact that anybody could come to New Jersey without even stepping foot in the state and set up whatever kind of company they would like with whatever protections they would like. And he actually led reformations in the state that cleaned up that entire sector. Now, this is not a particularly unique dynamic to New Jersey or to the U.S., but what we saw happen is as soon as New Jersey cleaned up, there was another state that was just lying there in wait, waiting for this fire hose of corporate funds to find a new home. There was a writer from the era that compared it to a Klondike gold rush. You know, the Klondike gold rush, you know, all kinds of money out of Alaska from the period. It was a very topical a comparison. The Klondike Gold Rush of corporate monies. Where was it going to be redirected to? Where was it going to find a new home? There was Delaware. It was the same dynamic. A smaller state, not many natural resources, not much economic base. But Delaware took advantage of Wilson's reforms. And we have had a century now of Delaware being the corporate leader, the leader in pro-corporate secrecy, pro-corporate protections. And as we now know, the anonymity and the shell company formation structures that these kleptocratic figures, these arms traffickers, narco traffickers, oligarchs, anti-American figures all around the world come to and rely on, taking advantage of those corporate reforms. You know, these were never meant to be attracting Russian oligarchs or Chinese oligarchs or the Iranian regime, et cetera. But these are the structures that they took advantage of. And there's a reason now that Delaware has never given up the crown. It took advantage of Wilson's reforms, and it has sprinted with it and has continued sprinting for an entire century.
Well, it's funny because it's very similar to the way that kleptocrats and dictators exacerbate other problems that are, they didn't create them, you know, but they exacerbate the cleavage, and they get it to a point where it's out of control and it's in fact undermining democracy, right? I mean, that's the whole thing. That's a lot of the discussion in disinformation. That's a lot of the discussion in even some election interference type stuff. I mean, there's so many different ways in which this is happening. That's kind of the MO of our adversaries these days. I mean, it's really interesting you specifically point out the kind of like federalism aspect to this, because that in a lot of ways is kind of the issue we constantly run into, right? I mean, it's like the federal government has only just banned anonymous shell companies, and we're still awaiting the rule. I mean, we're so far behind so many others. We've only just introduced the bill that will, you know, that the Enablers Act that we've spoken about, and will provide for Treasury authority to, you know, make basic due diligence rules for these individuals who, I mean, at the state level, generally are claim at least some level of regulation, even though it ends up being normally nothing or full of holes or full of whatever, because the states are trying to get business. So I guess if I could put this in like two sort of questions, I mean, is there an easy, there's no easy solution, but is there a solution to the subnational issue? Because it is really extraordinary to watch, you know, American national security be undermined in Bismarck, South Dakota, right? I mean, it is kind of an unbelievable thing to even consider.
And it's an ironic thing, right? We are sowing the seeds of our own demise, so to speak.
Yes, and in a place that, you know, would constitutionally have no authority over national security, right? I mean, that's the compact between states. I mean, we talk about federalism and states' rights, and that's important, and states should be able to make decisions. But the whole point why we banded together was for our collective security. I mean, that is the sole prerogative of the national government, the federal government, is so we could defeat the Brits, right, Nate? I mean, that's what it's all about. I mean, at the end of the day, that is federalism. So it is extraordinary to me to watch the states undermine the national security of the whole. It is supposed to be out of many one, right? But it looks like one is undermining many.
Just quickly though, just Casey, because you obviously have wrote a reply there, but just as you poked me, Paul, I'm going to sort of come up with a sort of devil's advocate thing. You know, the other point of the states banding together under a federal system was to act as sort of laboratories for democracy, right? The ideas that could be tested out in the states might then be adopted on the federal level, or if they didn't need to be, they could copy by other states. And that was kind of one of the ideas behind American sort of federalism. I guess what we're looking at here is a case where, yes, there are laboratories of democracy, but sometimes, of course, experiments go wrong. And one of the wonderful things about the American system is that there is a federal government to step in and correct these things. And we are kind of seeing that, maybe not as soon or as quickly as we would have liked that, but they have banned anonymous shell companies. You do now have a law or a bill at least out there talking about expanding the scope of the anti-money laundering system. So one of the things I liked, Casey, about your book was also that there is a bit of optimism, particularly towards the end. But what are your, you know, how do you feel about that? Do you feel in the sort of like arc of history, the US is like, is there a sort of like irredeemably sliding because of all this stuff? Or do you feel like this is just a kind of like, yes, it's not great, but, you know, ultimately we are sort of self-correcting in the way that I described.
Yeah, Nate, that's a great question. I'll get to Paul's here first because I think Paul, this notion of this idea of federalism, certainly it's been kind of, battered and bruised over the last few decades as we see increasing consolidation of federal power, federal rights over the kind of, again, nominally sovereign rights. And that's, I don't know, maybe a separate discussion. That's obviously a far greater issue in terms of the totality of issues encompassed as it pertains to counter-kleptocracy. I mean, the verdict is clear. The states will not clean up themselves. They will not stop. They have no incentive to whatsoever. And again, the book goes into far more details about what those incentive structures actually look like. And the same can and should be said about the industries themselves that have been taking advantage, that have been acting as enablers for these kleptocratic networks. Self-policing, self-regulation is an oxymoron when it comes to these industries,
yeah.
When it comes to these figures and these businesses that are increasingly relying on kleptocratic funds to buoy themselves and to increase their own revenue intake. So I think at the end of the day, there is a very clear scope for or direction of where the answers have to come from, and that's the federal government. And that's not to say that was the first possible answer. That's not right. To say that should be the first response, but that's certainly where we are now, because there is no reason to think the states or the industries will end this or will clean this up themselves. Hopefully they answered the question, Paul. Nate, I'm so happy you brought up that phrase, laboratories of democracy. There was a great paper last year, maybe 2 years ago, from a scholar at Stanford University, a gentleman named Bryce Tuttle, who's one of the leading scholarly counter-kleptocracy voices. Happy to cite him in the book. And as memory serves, the title of the paper is Laboratories Not of Democracy, but Laboratories of Secrecy. And his paper goes through, and again, I relied on it for part of the section detailing the transformation of the shell company industry in the U.S., how it is that states like Delaware perfected the art of the anonymous shell company. Again, experimenting, reforming, playing around with different kind of regulatory structures that would allow Delaware to remain at the head of the pack. Because, again, Delaware is only one state of 50. There are other states that are challenging Delaware's crown, states like Nevada, states like Wyoming, that, again, the political science term is race to the bottom. But I just love this idea that these are, this notion of the states as a laboratory of a democracy has really been perverted in a certain way. There are other areas where we see similar dynamics, but as it pertains to shell companies and pro-offshoring industries, it really has become this kind of laboratory of secrecy over and over and over again. I will say, Nate, the short answer is yes. I am ultimately optimistic. Maybe that optimism is misplaced. Maybe it has no grounding in fact or basis. Maybe it's just because I've had too much coffee in me. I don't know what it is, but it's still, who knows? Maybe it's because I spend so much time with you guys and we're all kind of, I don't know. We're equal parts cynical and optimistic. So I won't go down that route. But absolutely, in just the last 2 years alone in the U.S., we have seen unprecedented momentum, unprecedented legislation, unprecedented efforts at first recognizing the issue, but beyond that, doing something about it. I don't mean to toot our own horn, but the fact that the kleptocracy initiative exists is reason enough itself for some form of optimism. But you combine that with the increasing governmental understanding of the problem, understanding of what needs to be done, the increasing transnational conversations happening between civil society activists, between those of us in the kind of think tank or academic world, as well as officials. Even take something like the Counter-Kleptocracy Caucus. I can't remember who was involved in the formation of that exactly. I think he has one of the opening quotes in my book, actually. I'll have to take a look later. But the fact that something like that exists. Now, again, this is all to be seen. This is all to be determined, where things go, what happens next. But, we are driving our own fate. We are now steering at least part of the conversation. And unlike the early 1990s, when we did see the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and when you can trace so much of these kleptocratic developments too, there is now a chorus in Washington and elsewhere highlighting these issues, forcing others to address and stare at these issues. And then beyond that, recognizing the damage, not just to the source countries themselves and these flagging democracy movements elsewhere, these quote unquote transitioning democracies that only ended up transitioning into dictatorship, but the kind of results on the ground here in the U.S. to American communities, cities, polities, states, industries, et cetera. I mean, all of it together, yes, it gives me reason for tempered and cautious optimism, but optimism nonetheless.
So KCI, of course, share your optimism. That's why I do this job. History is made by the optimists. You have to believe you can do something in order to do it. But I'll share, and I may have on this podcast before. I don't know. I with you boys sometime. But I made a dig at the Brits today, so I'll say something nice. And that's my favorite quote about optimism in America is attributed to Churchill, like many things. But it is you can always trust the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And I think in this situation we have successfully tried everything else. So it's about time we just solve this problem.
And I will say to that point, I mean, Paul, you're exactly right. We can, you know, pick any case study or example you want of that. But you know, the reality is this can't be and won't be cleaned up or ended or fixed without the Americans, without the U.S., and specifically without U.S. leadership. It doesn't need to be sole leadership. It can certainly, you know, and should be done in a broadly allied manner with democracies elsewhere, with other Western jurisdictions. But you can't have the successful counter-kleptocracy movement without the American example, the American movement, and in many ways, the American leadership. It is absolutely a necessity in this space. Again, ironically enough, given that I wrote a book all about how the U.S. has transformed into a destination country for so much of this illicit wealth.
So let me ask you one more thing before I run, because I do have to run. But I want to ask, because to me, you know, we think about end state kleptocracy. I mean, where's end state counter kleptocracy? When do we win? You know, and then I guess that's, you know, to me, there's the legal side of this, which we're working on, but then there's also the normative side of this. I mean, it's kind of like you mentioned Woodrow Wilson just of his own volition, right, saying no to dirty money. Like, I mean, this happens, and it must happen. You know, I mean, is that the end state? Is it where no American in their right mind would ever even think of working for a dictator? I mean, where are we headed? I guess when do we know that we're done, Casey? When do we know that I can retire and light up a cigar and, you know, have some scotch?
When can we record our last podcast?
Right.
Yeah. The final making a killing. The killing has been made, and now we're done.
Yeah,
now
right. The killing's made. It's over.
Yes, but Paul, I don't know that I spent a lot of time thinking about what the end state or end stages look like. In many ways, I would imagine it resembles the kind of formulations that we saw in the early 1990s imaginations of an end of history. Right, the spread, obviously, on the one hand of democratic liberalism, but also under the rubric of, you know, competitive capitalism and of this kind of broader allowance of entrepreneurialism, and you know, that leads to obviously rising tides of domestic wealth, of stability, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it is of a piece with the spread and the entrenchment of democracy on this planet. And I will say, you know, to that end, democracy has been battered and bruised, certainly in this case, for years and years on end, but certainly in previous eras, for years and decades on end. And at the mm-hmm. end of the day, certainly through horrific cataclysms on the one hand, or just the slow grinding of eventual pro-democracy movements, we do see the seeds of eventual success. We do see, however dark and certainly pessimistic things may seem right now, we do see elements of optimism, elements of reason for expansion, elements of reason for belief that we can actually tackle this. I don't know, Paul, that you and I are ever going to kick back and light up a cigar. That might be something for our children or grandchildren to do at some point. But I do have faith that we'll get there. I do believe that we will ride out and eventually succeed over these forces of kleptocracy, of autocracy, of dictatorship, and of broader anti-Western, anti-democratic forces. I do have faith that will be done, because it has been done in the past. It has been done by previous generations. We just so happen to be the generation that has this issue in front of us, and we know it needs to be done. And it's just a matter of actually implementing those policies, those normative behaviors, and making sure those are entrenched and can't be eroded for future generations.
I was in a meeting today where it was asked, you know, can we do this? You know, is it inevitable? Is it over? And I was thinking, you know, if a Kansas, it's what you're saying, you know, if a Kansas farm boy that's never fought or fired a gun before can pick up a gun, fly over to Europe, and stop a genocidal empire, then we can stop the kleptocrats. You know, like we can do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, again,
well, that's quite a.
Oh, go ahead, Nate.
quite a note to end on, because we are sort of coming up to time. I just looked down and saw the time. I could easily spend at least three or four times, the amount of time we've had today talking to you about your book, Casey. It is to my mind, that the best one that's come out so far on these aspects of our issue that we talk about so much on the podcast. And a heartfelt congratulations to you on a massive achievement. Everyone listening, American Kleptocracy is out on November 23rd. You can pre-order it now. Make sure you do. Paul and I both read it, as have many experts. It's been positively reviewed by basically everywhere it's gone. The Economist I was reading yesterday. So congratulations on those as well, Casey. But it's a riveting read, but it's also just incredibly informative about the background and how, as we said, or like how all these financial secret mechanisms came to be. So go ahead, order it, and well, I guess we'll see you next week. Casey, you look like you have a final word there. You got one of your quotes.
Well, I was going to say, I do just want to highlight that while Paul does get one of the first words of the book, Nate, you do get one of the final words of the book. I guess I don't want to spoil it for readers, but just keep an eye open in the final chapter for our dedicated host and the kind of effect he has had and the role he has played, hopefully for posterity's sake, in this book for future generations.
Well, that really does have to be the final word, I'm afraid. So thanks for joining us today, Casey.
Happy to be here.
See you around.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Making a Killing, the podcast from Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative on how corruption is reshaping global politics. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to subscribe and share with your friends. You can also give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That really helps get the word around. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.